Good afternoon. It's 2:45. We appreciate the patience of the room. The House Judiciary Committee is convening for the final time this legislative session. Final time I will be holding the gavel. In committee today we have Representative Lynn, Representative Gruenberg, Representative Herron, Representative Ramris, Representative Holmes, Representative Gatto. We anticipate seeing Representative Dahlstrom at some time. In attendance, it's a privilege to have the bill sponsor, Senator Pascavan, and his chief of staff, Jeff Stepp, is here. And then honored to have my best friend in the legislature, Senator Wagner, here. And a mentor of mine from Fairbanks is also with us, Senator Ralph Seekins and his wife, Connie. It's people from Fairbanks that are visiting from the convention. Pat Fink, I'm delighted to see you. And then also Assemblymember Mark Ewing is here from Wasilla. We're delighted to have you here as well, Mark. Welcome. And then I want to thank Jane Pearson. Jane, for all your work over the last 4 years, since she just walked out of the room. And Susan Rael, who has done our work for the last 4 years. Susan, you've gotten every word right. We are very, very appreciative.
She has a green sidekick still.
Indeed. Indeed. So with that... Here in the waning hours of the second year of the 26th legislative session, we have convened to take up the CS for Senate Bill 303, and it was waived out of Labor and Commerce yesterday, and we have here the bill sponsor, Senator Pascavan. Senator Pascavan, if you want to join us, we have a number of people here in the room who wish to offer testimony. And I anticipate we've got folks online. Senator, we are scheduled to go on the floor at 5, but I don't think there's a person at this table who believes that we will. So we are set to take up this issue for some time. And we welcome you if you introduce yourself for the record. And I want to say before you do, Senator, you just carried a bill for me on the floor, Senate Bill 253 for my friend Rocky Pavey. And Rocky's wife, as you know, has undergone surgery. She's not doing well. She's failed to regain consciousness since Tuesday. So I would ask the members in the room just to take a moment of silence and pray for my friend Catherine Pavey. Amen. I've known Rocky since the ninth grade. Greatest quarterback Lathrop High School ever put out. Not really, but I always tell him that, and it always galls him to no end. Senator, with that, if you'd introduce yourself for the record and offer us your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I do thank you for your patience and do welcome the opportunity to appear before you in these last several days of the 2010 legislative year. And I'd like to begin by stating that that I do anticipate that there is going to be vigorous debate here while this committee seeks to try to find out what is the best public policy for the state of Alaska. I will begin just with a few statistics so that we have a little bit of context that this arises in. According to the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, that there have been 455 fatalities in the Alaska workplace since 1993. In that same period of time, there have been literally tens of thousands of injuries in the Alaska workplace. We do know, Mr. Chairman, that Alaska can be a dangerous place to work. It is imperative that the men and women who work in our industries, when there is fault, are made whole when they are injured. And this is part of a concept that there is accountability and responsibility in the workplace when workers who are injured or killed due to the fault of others have access to justice. Senate Bill 303 would not apply to every single injury that I mentioned above or every single fatality that I mentioned above. In fact, it only addresses a segment of those total injuries. What we are talking about today applies to those workers who are injured or killed due to the fault of a party other than their employer. And these can be complicated issues, and you will have testimony from for example, Trina Hikas, she is the director of the Division of Workers' Comp, and Gray Mitchell, Director of Labor Standards and Safety, to answer specific questions that you have about their areas of expertise. Currently, Mr. Chairman, due to changes that were enacted in 2004, and there's a legal memo that has been presented to you, an owner or a general contractor currently avoids all liability for an injury or a death to an employee of a subcontractor that occurs on the job site, even if that owner or general contractor acts with criminal negligence.
Senator, can you direct me to that document, please?
I don't seem to.
Did you say? I'm sorry, I wasn't listening. Did you say something that we have in our package?
I believe that it's a document that addresses questions about whether there is or is not liability, for example, for criminal negligence, and Mr. Stepp could assist if the chair or any member needs to find that specific document in their package.
If you could help us with that, Jeff, but just continue with your testimony, we'll.
Anyway, Mr. Chair, the core of the issue here is if there is fault, the question is whether there's accountability and responsibility for that fault. And the purpose of Senate Bill 303, Mr. Chairman, is to simply repeal the 2004 legislation and put Alaska back in what I would submit are the good policy grounds that existed in this state from the time of the drafting of our Constitution at the time of statehood, and for the 45 years that followed statehood, that was a good public policy that worked for business and it worked for the working people of Alaska. I would like, for starters, to draw attention to the sponsor statement for the 2004 Senate bill, which at that time was Senate Bill 323. And the Senate sponsor statement at that time advanced two principal modifications that were advanced as to why then Senate Bill 323 should change the law that had existed at the time of statehood. One, the first reason was that responsibility for payment of compensation was extended up the chain to include project owners, and number two, it indicated that injured parties in receipt of benefits would be barred from double dipping via a tort liability claim. And Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I would like to first discuss the second principal modification of that 2004 legislation, the so-called double dipping. And I submit to you that is an erroneous presentation. There is no double dipping. The statutes of Alaska, and specifically Alaska Statute 2330.015G, has expressly provided that any recovery by the injured person requires a reimbursement to the insurance carrier for the workers' compensation. But I think it's also important to...
Senator, yes. Representative Gatto has a question.
Thank you, Chair. Senator, I was looking for a copy of the bill you referenced. Was it 323 in 2004?
The law as it currently reads under the workers' compensation, and at that time it was called Senate Bill 323. This bill is 303.
Correct. I didn't know if it wasn't included in the packet that I have. I was going to read it, but I can't find it, and I'm assuming it just wasn't included, and then instead you have the statute in here?
I believe the statutes that we're talking about are 2330.045 and I believe 055.
Right.
Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
Mr. Representative Gatto, you should have in your packet a thing by Senator Seekins. It says sponsor, Senate Bill 323 sponsor statement. It should be a packet in there. And the first thing is Senator Seekins' sponsor statement. And if you look down, the last document in that is a copy of the bill itself. So we all have a copy of Senate Bill 323 as it was enacted.
I don't have it in my packet either.
You don't have this?
Senate Bill? Yeah, I don't have that.
Oh.
I'm looking all over for it.
Take a brief, please. We're waiting. We have before us Senate Bill 323 sponsor statement and the attached piece of legislation. And the legislation was dated 5/5/04 is the date that I show. All right. Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe that it's important at this time, since we were discussing that one of the second primary criteria that was advanced in 2004 was this double-dipping argument. But if one reads Alaska Statute 2330.015G, and I'll just read two sentences from that. If the employee or the employee's representative recovers damages from the third person, the employee or the representative shall promptly pay to the employer the total amounts paid by the employer under this statutory provision, insofar as the recovery is sufficient after deducting all litigation costs and expenses. Any excess recovery by the employer representative shall be credited against any amount payable by the employer thereafter, which essentially means...
Understood, Senator. Senator, I'll just point out to you that that infers, and I'm speaking as a citizen legislator who's a private employer, that infers that I'm content with being sued outside of the work comp, outside of the workers' comp coverage that I carry. And so I'm just, you know, I'm a layperson. I also want to recognize that our colleague, Senator Thomas, is in the room. Welcome, Senator Thomas. It's, man, I feel like I'm super forces here. I got three senators and one ex-senator. Man, we're ready to get it on here. Holy cow. Go ahead, Senator.
Yes, Mr. Chair, you as the employer of the hypothetical injured employee, you never lose your immunity from tort claims, because that is within the and recognized under the exclusive remedy provisions. That is within the capitalistic system. The employer chooses their employee, and the employee chooses their employer. And if the employee does not believe that the employer is safe, they can look to another employer that would be more safe to work for, and if the employer does not believe the employee is safe enough, then it is cause for termination of that employee, and then the employer seeks a more safe employee. So that is with the exclusive remedy provision arises within that capitalistic concept of the employer choosing their employees and the employees choosing their employers, and over time you advance and you promote job safety with that capitalistic operation. And that somewhat arises out of the determination approximately 100 years ago, which said that as part of the advancing of American commerce and American industry, that each business, whether it is a product or a service business, should inherently bear the cost of injury or death as part of their products on an or services on an overall basis. But again, Mr. Chair, the issue is that as a matter of statutory law, there is no double dipping, whether it is for benefits paid up to date as of the time of the tort liability recovery, nor even as to future benefits that might be paid under comp, that the tort recovery is simply looked at it as an advance of those, so that you as an employer do have no potential risk to your employee of any tort liability whatsoever. The only question is whether above that chain, if you were the subcontractor and the person that you were subcontracting with, or a contractor above them, or the project owner, if their fault were to injure your employee, and typically employers have good working relationship with their employees, that you would be protective of your employee, you have an invested asset in that employee, and you you want to make sure that that employee is protected as much as possible. And when that employee is hurt or killed, you want to make sure that that person or that person's family is taken care of reasonably well. And you provide that through workers' comp if the fault is within that employer-employee unit. But if it is outside of that employer-employee unit, then you say, look, that is the person that should be responsible for the injury to my employee, with the reimbursement statutory structure And I think it also bears pointing out that in Alaska, we have a portion fault. So if a project owner or general contractor is 25% at fault, they only owe 25% of the damages. So this is not a system that you would be enacting where somehow or another, because fault is proven, that now they are 100% of responsible to the injured person. It is only for the express percentage or allocated fault. And that includes, for example, if the employee is comparatively at fault, and a 50-50 example, if the employee is 50% at fault and a project owner were 50% at fault, the only risk to the project owner is 50% of the responsibility and accountability for that injury.
Senator, how do you know so much about this subject?
Well, you know, Mr. Chair, you know, I am in my 30th year of practice as a lawyer, and I have over the years represented both the people that have been injured and killed, and I've also represented insurance, workers' compensation insurance carriers seeking to obtain recovery of their monies where they are advancing me costs and to make sure that I can recover for the workers' compensation insurance companies. And I have also over my career represented general liability insurance carriers. So I have you know, so to speak, worked both sides of the fence. You know, I believe that I understand the system reasonably well. There are people in the room, for example, Trina Hykus and Gray Mitchell, that understand the workers' compensation system much more clearly than I do, but in the context of the fault and the allocation of fault and the attaching of responsibility and accountability for that, that is what I've done for 30 years.
So this subject matter is in the sweet spot of your vocation, so to speak.
I believe that I understand it well, Mr. Chair. I am, so to speak, though, in the sunset years of my career, so I do not expect to be in this field for very much longer. Again, I'm in my 30th year of practice.
Understood, Senator. So respectfully, just so that we're clear on the hurdle rate for this piece of legislation, I had a member of industry who called me today and said that this was full-time employment for personal injury attorneys was the way that this piece of legislation was framed to me by somebody within industry. Just so I can't as eloquently articulate the other side of the issue, but I'm quite certain that there is another side of the issue, and that was how somebody in industry described it to me this morning during the fire drill. Just so there's context.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The ultimately, I think it's important for me to get back to what I think is the core principle, and it's a principle that myself as a family person with children, and I believe other people that are family people with children, it's a value that they pass on to their children as far as personal responsibility, that you say, look, if you break it, you have to be responsible for it. And that is a very core and essential value, I think, not only that I believe that it is appropriate for me to convey to my children, but I think that in a capitalistic system, which I you know, we are operating in, that those that are engaged in activities for profit, that they as well should be responsible, that if they break it, that they pay for it. And this whole concept of immunity from their own fault, from a historical perspective, it arose out of what we call the common law that developed in Europe hundreds of years ago. And it's the concept was that the king could do no wrong. And if the king can do no wrong, no matter how bad the conduct of the king was, there was no redress by citizens against the king for the king's wrong. And we fought a war 235 years ago that said we as Americans disagreed with immunity. We believe that the king should be accountable and responsible to the citizens for the king's wrongs. We have redressed for our grievances. And when you have the immunity that is put in place in 2004, we create little kingdoms. And we say that they want to seek immunity because it is a comfortable place to be when you are not accountable and responsible for your activities. You are not accountable and responsibility for your bad behaviors. And again, the spectrum of that bad behavior includes everything from general negligence to gross negligence to criminal negligence to reckless indifference. All of those concepts of fault that every one of us, I believe, on a moral basis, believe should be recognized as wrong in our society have been immunized, and essentially we have created little kingdoms that say they're immune. And again, I think that is not the best policy. It is not good policy. I believe that returning to the policy choices that were made in Alaska at the formation of this state that have been followed by business and industry for the 45 years that followed the formation of this state. There was no open the floodgates of litigation, so I think that those arguments are overblown and exaggerated. I think that this is a system that has worked well. It's a system, again, that to some extent you're asking me about my involvement in this line of work. I believe that it is the proper and appropriate balance, and I think that at its core it has conservative principles and capitalistic incentives as part of that. And I certainly would open up. Again, I am absolutely anticipating vigorous debate on this, and would welcome any questions by any of the committee members of me as to any aspect of this. I think I've probably spoken enough at the moment, and would open it up to any questions so that if there is confusion, that I will hopefully directly answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator. And I'd like to put on the record that nobody has been more respectful to me in this building than you have over the last 2 years, and I'm grateful for the strong rich friendship that you've developed. But on this point, our points of view could not be more antithetical. So with that, I'll open up questions for the bill sponsor, Representative Grunberg.
Just to follow up on a question you asked about his potential involvement in that, Mr. Chair. I note that Section 2 of the bill excludes from contractors, had excluded a vendor whose primary business is the sale or leasing of tools, equipment, other goods, or property. And the statute that's being repealed in Section 4 basically says the same thing. I'm wondering, Mr. Chair, and also Senator Pasquin, would that include somebody who owns a restaurant or a hotel who supplies food to a worker? And that might injure that person on the job. But that person would have enjoyed immunity under this, but if the bill passes, no longer would.
I believe that the intent, even in 2004, was that if a product, for example, a man lift was brought on site or a food product was brought on site and injured a person, that was not considered within the vertical hierarchy, and therefore concept of liability remained as it was before 2004. But I believe that that's what happened, so that there would be if they brought tainted food on the site and it injured the worker, there would be no immunity in this chain. I think that was an excluded.
I see. So this bill would have no effect on that.
That is correct.
I see. Okay.
Well, Senator, we look forward to you staying in the room with us, and I would be very happy to extend the privilege to you of coming back up to the table at such a time that you would like to participate and contribute with those that we take testimony from. Let me give the room an expectation of who we anticipate hearing from. Here in the room, we have with the Department of Law, DOL, WD, worker, what's WD? Department of DOL, WD. Ray Mitchell, Director of Labors and Safety. Okay. And available for questions, Brad Thompson, the Director of State of Alaska Risk Management, for questions. Our friend Don Etheridge is here with AFL-CIO, which wishes to testify. Trina Hikas with Work Comp, Director's here for questions. John Grunert was here with Alaska Independent Agents. Wayne Stevens is here with the State Chamber. Senator Seekins is here, wishing to testify, the author of the bill in 2004. Michelle Kale is here, who is a very sensitive witness who we look forward to hearing from and will treat very appropriately. Also offline, we have Rob Stone, Howard Gray with the Miners Association, Paul Laird with Support Industry Alliance, Kenton Bryan with Property Casualty Insurers Association, Kip Knutson with Tesoro, Maynard Tapp, Mike Holmes with his insurance agency, Janine St. John with Linden, John Lewis with the Iron Workers, and Stacy Allen from Palmer. So it appears that we have well represented both sides of the issue, and we get to wind up our time with a very robust discussion. So with that, I'm going to invite Don Etheridge to come up. Don, are you here? Department of Labor Workforce Development is DOLWD. Don, it has been a pleasure to get to know you over the last 6 years. You're a good man, and you're well-liked universally in this room. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, it's nice to see you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don Etheridge, on behalf of the Alaska State AFL-CIO, and we're very supportive of this piece of legislation, and we're of the same opinion as the sponsor of the bill, that if you break it, you need to pay for it. One of the things that I've seen a lot in your committee is scenarios. And the scenario that I'd like to put out there.
Scenarios for lay people, we like to call it.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
And I'm very lay.
Oh, my. That's why we understand each other.
So if at your hotel you have a subcontractor or a contractor's bringing buses in with a lot of folks on the buses, and your staff is out helping to offload those buses, if one of those bus drivers has had one too many or something and runs over and hurts one of your employees, is it fair that you have to pay a higher workers' comp rate because they goofed up, messed up?
Yes, that's the way the system works.
Yeah. Well, most of our folks don't think it's a very good idea.
Well, I'm sure you and I can agree that workers' comp is broken and does not work in a rational fashion. But that is the way it works, and those kind of things do happen in the workplace.
Right, and I think we need to fix them.
I agree.
And but we're very supportive of this piece of legislation, and we think that we should move it out. We appreciate it.
Roger that, Don. Are there any questions for Don? Privileged, as always. Nice to see you. Next, can we hear from Wayne Stevens, please? Welcome, Wayne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Wayne Stevens, President and CEO of the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce. The Alaska State Chamber opposes Senate Bill 303 regarding exclusive liability. Our position supports the changes regarding exclusive liability adopted by the legislature in 2004. Current law obligates the immediate employer and other project participants to pay an injured employee's workers' compensation benefits regardless of fault. In the unfortunate circumstance of an injury, a worker has a clear understanding about remedies being provided under the workers' compensation system. Prior to 2004, many subcontractors employed by a larger company, project owner, or employer were not required to carry workers' compensation insurance. Under current law, which passed in 2004, all employees, including subcontractors, now carry workers' compensation insurance except sole proprietors, which in all likelihood should carry workers' compensation insurance. The idea was that all workers on a job would be insured regardless of who may be their direct employer. Correspondingly, workers' compensation benefits, the employers associated with the project, is the exclusive remedy for potential liability. Prior to 2004, project owners, contractors, and their subs were expending tremendous resources in coordinating safety programs to defend against potential tort liability. Previously, project owners and contractors attempted to avoid tort liability by limiting their involvement with each other's safety programs and work performance. In other words, prior to 2004, the law actually discouraged project owners and other project participants from implementing and enforcing coordinated safe work practices. Under current law, project participants can take an integrated approach to completion of a project and can integrate safety programs. That is, project owners, contractors, and subcontractors work closely together to ensure that project specifications and safety standards are met and that all work is completed in a successful and safe manner. Second, the Alaska Workers' Compensation Act is intended to provide injured workers with a reasonable compensation for their work-related injuries without regard to fault or the cause of the injury. The system has been in place for almost 90 years. Some may claim that without the risk of exposure to tort damages, the project owners and other project participants have had little incentive to implement and enforce safe work practices. The 2004 law has allowed for increased safety awareness and coordinated safety programs interconnecting subcontractors and project owners together. The State Chamber has been steadfast advocates of reducing worker compensation expenses, particularly workers' comp insurance. However, continued improvement on insurance rates mean continued improvement on workplace safety. The tort system is not the only available means to punish companies that violate safety practices. There's federal OSHA, Department of Labor, Oil and Gas Commission, and other state agencies that have the authority to fine companies that violate safety standards. Those agencies also have the authority to shut down projects that pose a safety hazard to employees. When project owners, their contractors, and subcontractors work in an integrated manner, all companies involved in the contracting chain are subject to the fines and other remedies of those state agencies. This is a much more efficient, credible, and cost-effective means of policing job safety. At this time, and in accordance with our adopted legislative position, we cannot support Senate Bill 303.
Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Wayne? Representative Herron?
Thank you, Wayne. Of all your members, what is the most common claim an employee presents to his employer throughout Alaska?
I don't have that data available to me, sir. Through the chair, Representative Herron,
Is it serious injuries or minor injuries or?
My guess would be that the folks from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development could be far better prepared to answer those
Mr. Chairman.
Questions.
I know in my industry it's lacerations and slip and falls. Those are the things that are most common to hospitality. And Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple questions. Wayne, do we really think it's okay that general contractors and project owners be totally immune from liability for somebody who's injured due to their criminal negligence or other negligence?
I don't think that that's what we're here to talk about. I think that what we're talking about is a system that is broke, and we need to talk about how to fix the system, not interject another system into it. I mean, workers' comp Alaska pays some of the highest rates in the nation for workers' compensation coverage. And I mean, if there are things that we need to do to fix workers' comp, then that's what we should focus on. But interjecting tort into workers' comp, it creates a situation that prior to 2004, from our perspective, opportunities for things to occur within the legal system that drive the cost of doing business in this state even higher.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman. First off, I'm not quite sure I heard an answer in there, but it does lead to a follow-up question, which is, do we think it's fair for the subcontractors' workers' comp rates to go up when really the person who was negligent was the project owner or the general contractor?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, I'll be the first to admit that workers' comp is not a fair system, and I will be the first to admit that workers' comp needs some serious work. And, you know, I mean, this bill has moved very, very rapidly in the last less than 4 weeks. Certainly, we would encourage a task force or a committee interim to sit down with labor and others that are interested in this and try to figure out a way that addresses the concern.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I heard an answer really to either of those questions, but I'll
Representative Gatto.
Thanks. I think when a contractor hires a subcontractor to do sheetrock, and the subcontractor brings ladders, scaffolding, air tools, compressors, and all those things, and the subcontractor, in my mind, has control over the job. But what would happen if one of his employees simply wanted to use the bathroom and walked upstairs and the rail fell off in a person's home? Would that be the responsibility of the subcontractor for allowing him to use the stairs? Or would it be the responsibility of the homeowner? Or would it be responsibility of the general?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, the unfortunate reality is that I have not practiced in the legal profession, and I did not stay at a Holiday Inn Express last night, so I am in over my head when I try to answer a specific question relative to the law that you're trying to answer. There are attorneys and representatives of the legal profession in the room that would be far better prepared to answer those. I'll stick by our position that workers' comp is broke and it needs to be fixed.
And Mr. Chair, and sir, what I was getting at was, when a subcontractor accepts a subcontract, is he the responsible person for making sure that the stairways and the entryways and everything else are safe enough for his employees, or not?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, there's certainly a presumption that you enter a work site with things that are correct, whether that be the individual homeowner or other.
Thank you.
Representative Lynn?
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming here today. I just, you know, I look at this as just a layperson, but and I think oversight by OSHA and other oversight agencies is really a very good thing for the workplace. But to me, the question is, if one of these groups fines somebody for a workplace violation, that's good. But how does that directly help the injured worker? I mean, the company gets fined. Maybe they will improve their safety performance in the future. We hope so. But meanwhile, you've got an injured worker and his family. How does that help them directly or immediately or nearly immediately?
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, it probably doesn't.
Thank you.
Again, stand by my
responsibility. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. Mr. Stevens. I think we're all here to try to do what's right and fair, aren't we?
I believe so. Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, yes, sir.
And if somebody is injured, it's fair that their expenses be paid so that they are made whole and the arm broken gets fixed and stuff. Isn't that fair?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I believe that's the way the system works currently.
And so the real question, I think, through the chair, is who should pay? And isn't it fair that the person that's responsible, their carrier, should ultimately pay? Isn't that what's fair?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I think that's the whole premise of what we're arguing about, discussing, and debating, is does the system provide an adequate level of compensation for injuries or other occurrences? And I'm of the suggestion that the workers' comp system needs a tremendous amount of work. I believe introducing a bill like this late in the session, that...
I'm not trying to interrupt you. I'm trying to just get an answer to a question, if I may.
Representative Grunberg.
I'm looking at what Senator Pascvan said was the purpose of the bill, and if I may read this sentence, please. Folks, I'm reading the second paragraph in the sponsor statement, that basically in the law in 2004, when that was enacted, that protects a project owner or general contractor from any liability when the subcontractor's employee is injured or killed, even when the project owner or general contractor acts with criminal negligence. So in other words, the current law protects the project owner or general contractor from any liability, even when they act in a criminally negligent manner. You're not saying that's fair, are you?
through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, no, that's not what I'm saying.
Okay, thank you.
From my mind, work comp is an immediate remedy. And tort law is a delayed remedy. It pierces the veil of workers' comp, and then double jeopardy isn't the right phrase, but requires double insurance. Work comp ceases to be enough. Work comp ceases to be enough, and becomes not enough. And therein, if you have to have other insurance that's available, and it's subject to it's subject to be pierced, then the cost of your insurance becomes this catastrophic umbrella insurance, in fact, and then your premiums go up. And so now you're paying high premiums for two insurances, one for the workers' comp to pay for all the flaws that are embedded in the system, and now the other insurance coverages that you're carrying, now they are also going to go up because they're with the passage of this legislation, because now the your workers' comp is more likely to have the veil pierced. Representative Gatto?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to go to the same paragraph that Representative Gruenberg accessed, and it's line four, acts with criminal negligence when a criminal negligence is defined, so now we're taking off the word defined, in part as the risk must be of such a nature and degree that the failure to perceive it constitutes a gross deviation. And that word, that little phrase, failure to perceive it, constitutes a gross deviation from the standard of care. So we could have, normally, if the employer didn't perceive the dangerous situation in which no one else would have perceived, because unless we have a gross deviation from the standard of care, then the employer seems to be not acting with criminal negligence. So if we want to say that we need to include criminal negligence, we have to make sure that it isn't just that there was a situation, but it had to be failure to perceive it, and your words, gross deviation from the standard of care. Well, we don't know what gross deviation means, but it looks to me that an employer or a homeowner or somebody that's up the chain has at least some degree of some degree of exception here, because it's hard to prove those words, gross deviation from the standard care, that a reasonable person would observe in the situation. So I'm kind of at concerned here that I think we do allow for a person not to be accused of criminal negligence, even though it was his place, because no one would have noticed any more than a reasonable person would have noticed. Does that help make sense? Maybe it doesn't.
I got a little confused.
Wayne, we thank you. We thank you for your testimony, and it's been a pleasure. Pleasure to have you before the committees that I've served on for the last number of years. It's been a great deal to me. I appreciate your testimony. A great deal. Kevin Dougherty, we did get you online here. We're not going to you yet, but we did. But we did write down your name, so you're in the queue. Can we go to John Lewis in Anchorage with Ironworkers Local Union 751? John?
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. In 2004, a bill effectively changed Alaska Statute 2330-055 to provide immunity from legal challenges by workers injured while working on the job to project owners and general contractors. Prior to this change to the Workers' Compensation Act, an injured worker retained the right to pursue other companies and employers through legal action as a result of negligence. One of the outrageous arguments used to push the passage of this amendment to AS 2330-055 was that it would prevent double dipping by an injured worker. In short, keep a worker from receiving workers' compensation benefits as well as quote-unquote winning in a court through civil suit, hence the double dipping term. In reality, this argument was a red herring, since Alaska Statute 2330.15 was already in place and clearly stated if a worker did in fact receive money through court action, any benefits received through workers' compensation would be repaid, therefore eliminating any double dipping. What this law really did was create a path for general contractors and project owners, cut corners on safety with no fear of financial loss to the victims of accidents, while at the same time still allowing them the ability to sue down or sue subcontractors, or a very type of action that they themselves are now protected by this statute. For example, the ironworker industry is one that is affected by enormous workers' compensation rates due to the extreme risk involved. With the way 055 is now written, if an ironworker is hurt by the action of someone else, his employer will now be the one who will bear the cost. One accident could very easily raise the employer's workers' compensation rates to where they are no longer able to compete in the very competitive bidding process of steel erection. Why should the person responsible for an injury not be the responsible person when it comes time to pay for that situation? What is right, that is, if you cause an accident, then you should be the person who is responsible. Section 055, as it is now written, indemnifies everyone else who may be the true responsible party while essentially shifting the blame or cost to the employer, who very well may have taken every step humanly possible to safeguard their employees. This section of Alaska statute was formed to provide a clear path for resolution in the event a worker was injured or killed on the job, a means to clearly identify that the worker's exclusive remedy was to use workers' compensation insurance to take care of costs to regain their health. Instead, it has become a method for general contractors and owners to push subcontractors to cut corners on safety to reduce their overall cost. I'm not going to accuse anyone of intentionally cutting costs, knowing that they are going to hurt or kill someone, but I would say that it is easy to cut costs in the hopes that no one gets hurt. How many estimators do you know who would like their boss to know they save money on the job? I would venture to say all of them. Members of the House, I respectfully ask for your support in passing Senate Bill 303, which will simply restore 2330055 as it was originally written prior to the 2004 change. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, John. I want to recognize that Representative Tammy Wilson from North Pole is here in the room with us. Welcome, Representative Wilson. John, would you please just read your name into the record and your affiliation, please?
My name is John Lewis, and I'm with Ironworkers Union 751.
And what do you do with the local?
I'm an organizer.
All right. Thank you very much. Can we next go to Stacy Allen in Palmer? Stacy, will you introduce yourself and your affiliation for the record, please?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Stacy Allen. I'm a registered nurse, and I'm also the healthcare unit representative for Laborers Local 341. And on behalf of the 2,200 members and their families, I want to state that we strongly support Senate Bill 303. We feel that this bill supports and enhances a culture of safety that our union and other unions have built up over the long years before 2004 with management and government. This bill will provide an incentive for employers to work together to maintain a safe work environment, and mostly by showing that negligence will not be tolerated and that there is a penalty for not being careful on the job and not providing a safe environment. I urge you on behalf of our members to move SB 303 out of committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Stacy? Stacy, seeing none, we thank you. We thank you very much. Can we next go to Rob Stone, please? Rob, are you with us?
Hello?
Hi, Rob. If you'd introduce yourself and any affiliation for the record, please.
Yes, my name is Rob Stone, and I thank you for allowing me to testify today. I'm wearing multiple hats. I'm a small business owner in Anchorage. I'm an attorney. I have represented workers' compensation employers. I have represented them that were insured, and I've also represented employers that were self-insured. I did that for about 6 years before switching over and doing plaintiff on the liability side. That's the type of work I do now. I've represented small businesses, large businesses. I have helped workers' compensation employers recover their 015G subrogation interest. I am a conservative Republican, and what might be of some surprise to many of you, I'm also president of the Alaska Association for Justice, which used to be the Alaska Academy of Trial Lawyers. With that, I think that Senator Aspin did a marvelous job in outlining the problems with the 2004 amendments to the Workers' Compensation Act, and also in doing a wonderful job in highlighting why we need to change the law back to the way it once was. And if you would indulge me for a moment, I would like to explain the basis and origins of workers' compensation in our country. About 90 years ago or so, states started passing workers' compensation laws, and they did so because there needed to be a compromise between employees and employers. When employees were hurt on the job, they were placed in a very difficult situation. Do you live with the injury, or do you sue your employer? And if you sued your employer, you could suffer the consequences. Years and years ago, people will be blackballed for suing their employers. And so as a consequence, many employees chose to work injured or take the risk of suing their employer and recovering damages. So as a compromise between employees and employers, the workers' compensation system emerged. And there were benefits to both sides. Employees compromised because in exchange for payment of benefits, they gave up their right to sue for all damages. And likewise, the employers compromised because in exchange for the waiver of liability, employers guaranteed payment to employees regardless of fault. And so therefore, even when the employer itself was not at fault, it guaranteed payment to the injured workers. And so the injured workers received benefits that were not full damages, and the employers agreed to pay but were shielded by the exclusive remedy doctrine, what is now known as the exclusive remedy doctrine. And it's important to recognize that that's a compromise between those two entities or persons. And now we're in a situation where in 2004, the legislation that was passed immunized third parties. And there are very few, if any, other situations within our American system of jurisprudence where others are immunized for their conduct. And Representative Ramirez, you asked earlier about whether you could be sued for the conduct of or negligence of others, and the answer to that is no. As the employer, you are immunized. You can put up the shield. The exclusive remedy doctrine protects you from suit from any of your employees. The way the system worked, and this has been the law for nearly 50 years in Alaska up until 2004, was that when an injured worker was hurt by the negligence of somebody besides his employer, he recovered workers' compensation benefits under his employer's insurance. And then he was able to go after the person who really hurt him. And then when he received compensation from that person, first he has to get written approval from his workers' compensation carrier, because they both have an interest in that, in those funds. And then under Section 015G, the workers' compensation carrier gets full reimbursement for the monies it paid out to its employee. And that's important because as a small business owner, when I go out to buy workers' compensation insurance, my insurance company assesses the risks. What risk is there that my secretary will be injured on the job in a law firm? And that's the basis for my premium. But if my insurance carrier has to say, Mr. Stone, we want to assess not only the risk of your employees getting hurt by your negligence, but we want to assess the risk of your employees getting hurt by others, my premiums are going up. In 2004, when this law was passed, when this Senate Bill 323 was passed and then went into effect, it raised the premiums of small business owners because now the insurance companies had to write policies that covered for not being able to get reimbursed from the general contractors, from anybody up the chain. They lost their 015G rights. Okay? And I think that's important to recognize. And as far as my core values, I am about personal responsibility, accountability. When somebody causes injury to somebody else, there needs to be accountability for that. Let me give you an example.
Pardon me. We appreciate your testimony, but we have a dozen more people. Can you find a way to conclude it, please, in a reasonable time?
I will, and I'm almost finished. And thank you, Chairman Ramirez. Mr. Stevens talked about insurance rates, and let me give you one example, then I will conclude. A subcontractor up on the slope has a worker, and he's walking around the work yard, and he's run down by a general contractor's employee who's driving an automobile. And let's say that general contractor's employee is not paying attention, and as a result, he runs over this kid and kills him. Right now, there's no liability to that general contractor or the person who ran down that kid. For 50 years, there was responsibility and accountability to that person who did it. Today, there is none. And that's just one of many examples as to why this law needs to be changed back to the way it was. And with that, I understand you have plenty of people to testify, and so I'm available for any questions anybody may have, because I understand that Mr. Stevens wasn't able to do so as a non-attorney.
Thank you, Rob. I appreciate it. Are there questions for Mr. Stone? Rob, I don't see any questions. We thank you very much for your testimony today.
We go next. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. We go next to Howard Gray, please, with the Miners Association. Howard, would you introduce yourself and your affiliation for the record, please?
Oh.
Hi, Howard.
Hello, can you hear me?
We can hear you now if you'll introduce yourself.
Oh, sorry about that.
Okay.
I'm Howard Gray. I'm here today for the Alaska Miners Association. I also manage a company and used to own companies, and so I'm pretty familiar with the workman's comp situation in Alaska. I try to keep my comments fairly brief, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. First of all, I'd like to say I think that the present system appears to work pretty well, particularly for employees. That's been my feeling and experience. Responsibility is defined. It's placed where it should be with the employer. And we talk about who should be responsible. Well, the employer should be responsible for both the supervision and safety of his employees. That's what he does. That's what he's assigned to do, and that's what he's paid for. If he doesn't think a situation is safe, then he should not put the employee in that position. The current concern we have with SB 303 is it will probably create a legal morass and something that we should avoid. It could also encourage lower-tier contractors, subs, to forego, ignore, or try to avoid work comp if they know someone else will shoulder the responsibility and liability. Now, that's not the case. The employer has that responsibility and liability. In looking at it, it doesn't appear that we're, with SB 303, we're correcting a problem or oversight. I noticed in the most recent changes to work comp that we expedited care, we expedited payments, we provided for rehabilitation and retraining for employees where it looked like it was needed. And it seems like the system overall is working fairly good. I realize there's some administrative issues. Maybe policing and other issues should be addressed by the administration. And it may be that additional funding should be secured for some of these state agencies so that perhaps a better job can be done. But overall, I think the responsibility is being placed where it belongs. And that's all I have. I thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gray. Are there questions for Mr. Gray? I don't see any. We thank you for your testimony, Mr. Gray.
Thank you.
Next, we'll go to Paul Laird, please. Paul, are you with us? No, he's gone? Okay. After Paul is Kenton Bryan with Property Casualty Insurance Association.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Kenton Bryan. I'm the Assistant Vice President, Regional Manager for Property Casualty Insurers Association. We are a national trade association of property casualty insurance companies who collectively write about one-third of the workers' compensation coverage presently in the state of Alaska. My remarks are going to be extremely brief today. I did want to simply state for the record that we are opposed to Senate Bill 303. As you have heard from other folks who are here testifying today, that this legislation would in fact pierce that veil on the exclusive remedy provisions of the current statutory requirements and expose general contractors to civil litigation and tort actions related to injuries on the job. And we feel that this is not a constructive method for keeping workers' compensation rates in the affordable range in a state in which they're obviously already extremely high, and it's a challenging marketplace. So we would encourage legislators to carefully consider the ramifications, and while we fully understand that there's a strong set of arguments being made in favor of this legislation, we just have to say that it cannot help but have an impact on insurance rates within the state of Alaska, and it's there may be better ways to consider how to increase the number of people on the job who are covered by workers' compensation insurance coverage. There may be ways to improve the workers' compensation system so that rates are more affordable for employers, contractors, and subcontractors alike. But we believe that in the long run, this legislation will only lead to higher costs for employers, for general contractors and subcontractors, and that's not going to be beneficial in the long run to Alaska's economy or to workers injured on the job.
Mr. Chairman, we have a question. For you, Kenton, from Representative Herron.
Yes, Mr. Bryan, is a couple of times you mentioned that there are better ways or other ways that this legislation could take to solve a perceived problem. Please give one example.
Well, I think that, thank you, through the chair, Representative, one thing that I've been looking into since becoming aware of this legislation recently is whether or not Alaska's workers' compensation laws have mandates in them similar to what is found in other states, such as Florida, for example, where there are requirements for contractors, not only all workers on a job site to have workers' compensation coverage, either provided by themselves or provided by the contractors for whom they work, but also other requirements in place that provide more oversight to make sure that those laws are being followed. I think that the goal of any workers' compensation system has to be to provide the greatest amount of access to workers' compensation coverage for people who are working so that they have access to care. And then, of course, the other long-term goal of a workers' compensation system is to try and treat injuries and get people back on the job as quickly as possible. And if you have a system that encourages all the workers to be covered and has oversight to make sure that those policies are in place, for people, then you also probably have a system that encourages greater risk management oversight by insurers to make sure that those policies are being followed, that work sites are safe, and that when someone is injured, every effort's being made to rehabilitate the injured worker and get them back to work.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to re-ask a couple of questions I asked earlier. Do you think that it's fair, should a general contractor or project owner be completely immune from liability when somebody is injured or killed on their job site due to their criminal negligence?
through the chair, Representative, of course, it would be difficult for me to say that I think that that's fair. It sure doesn't sound very fair. But I have to say that I'm not qualified, I don't feel qualified to understand Alaska statutes as they currently exist well enough to say that there is no existing remedy. I have been reading during the hearing the legal services memo, which I believe is a little less clear than is helpful for me as a non-attorney to understand whether or not there is actually some liability there or for intentional acts. It's an insurance principle, not necessarily limited to workers' compensation, but it's an insurance principle in the broader P&C context that if an intentional act is being perpetrated, then insurance isn't even necessarily coming into play because we don't pay for intentional acts. So if there's a pattern of behavior by a project owner or a general contractor, it seems to me that it's going to be difficult for them to get insurance in the first place if there's a pattern of that kind of intentional behavior. So I wish I was a bit more familiar with Alaska statute, but my quick read of it leaves it a little bit difficult for me to say with certainty that there is no liability exposure beyond outside of workers' compensation coverage for a project owner currently.
Mr. Chairman, follow up. And I think I heard a no, that doesn't sound fair at the beginning of that, which I actually agree with. Mr. Chairman, the follow-up question is whether or not it's fair for subcontractors' workers' comp rates should go up when the injuries are due to the negligence or criminal negligence of the general contractor or the project owner.
Through the chair, again, Representative, it certainly does not sound like a fair circumstance if that is occurring. But I think that insurers do their best to try and analyze what the root causes are of workplace accidents through their risk management programs. And I don't think that it's a fair assertion that workers' comp rates would automatically go up in any given circumstance due to the negligence of others on the job site. I don't agree with the assertion.
Hey, Ken, a quick question for you. Does work comp cover an employer who acts in criminal negligence?
Well, that's the question I was kind of trying to get to before. Off the top of my head, I don't know the answer to that, Mr. Chairman, but I will do my best to find an answer quickly here and get back to you with it. But I, again, that's a broader insurance principle that insurance typically does not cover the intentional acts of the insured. If you have a homeowner's policy and you burn down your own house on purpose, we don't pay you for that. So I'm wondering how that applies in the workers' compensation context. Obviously, there are probably some attorneys in the room who know the answer better than I do, but I'll see if I can get an answer.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for Kenton? I don't see any at the table. We thank you very much for your testimony, Kenton.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Can we come back to Kevin Dougherty, please? Kevin, are you with us?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Kevin Dougherty from Eagle River, representing Alaska laborers, and I've been active in the work comp area since about 1981. I've never made any money at it in terms of all the work I've done has been pro bono assisting people, but I've also served on Governor Hickel's Committee on Work Comp in about 1990, I believe. I certainly support SB 303. As the restoration of the, we've had very traditional values in work comp since 1915. And for those like myself that like to look at the history and believe in traditional values, you can look back and you can see in 1915, fortunately in Alaska, we respected those traditional values of looking out for widows and injured Alaskans, injured people. And we retained those up until the year 2004. Until the loophole was created. So this bill fortunately would correct that loophole, fill it back in. It goes to the second out of 3 points I'd like to make. The second point is that, the bill finally restores the incentive for safety. In Alaska, since I've been here in 1981, we have had great safety programs that took off in, starting in about the mid-'80s, and to the great credit of companies like BP Alaska, BP started a great safety program in the 1980s, way before, by the way, the 2004 amendment. They have a program called the NSTC, or the North Slope Training Cooperative, where everyone that works in Prudhoe Bay and up in the North Slope has to go through that program to assure that they're safe-minded and that they understand the safety program. AGC Alaska, another great organization, they have had a safety program that they instituted, I think it was about 1995, under Dick Catnaugh, because Dick Catnaugh cared about safety. That was 10 years before the 2004 amendment came along. You can look at other organizations. Alaska Pipeline, I think, started their program, their quarterly meeting, the safety program that they had early 1990s, great program. So we need to be very honest to say that we have had safety in this state from 1980, so we're talking, you know, close to 30 years ago. It wasn't contingent on anything that occurred in the year 2004. Finally, last thing I'll say and then finish. I think it's really important that we make sure that the law is honest and straightforward. When we want to have a definition of employer, it should be the employers. It shouldn't be some other party. The political doublespeak in statute is not a good thing for us. It's not good public policy. And if you, whenever you talk to a widow or an injured worker, and I've talked to 100 over the years, I've been involved in this, they're expecting honesty from the system. So I appreciate that the sponsor is restoring that back to the law, and I think it's a wonderful, courageous move that I appreciate the senator taking. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for Kevin Dougherty, Representative Gatto?
Thank you. What did you mean by political doublespeak in statute? Do you have a reference or some specific area that you're referring to?
Yeah, thank you, Representative Gatto, through the chair. For those of us that have read about political doublespeak out there, back to the book 1984, you know, that's where that comes from. I think, fortunately, you look at statutes, normally a definition, you know, for example, the definition of an employee is in the work comp statute, and an employee has to be the person who is working for you. It can't be anyone more than that, and the same thing should apply here. The employer is, we know who it is in practical terms. I have an employer, and we all typically do, and it's, and the definition of employer was artificially expanded in 2004, and I don't think that's forthright, and it's not accurate. Thank you.
Follow up,
please.
Would an employer be the one who, on Friday at 5 o'clock, gives you a paycheck?
That's it. You're paid by your employer. Yes.
And if I continue, would an employer then extend to anyone else besides the one who gives you your paycheck? For instance, you might work for General Motors and in a division and receive a paycheck for installing lug nuts. And your employer, is your employer the one who gave you your paycheck, which is somebody in Dearborn, or is your employer the CEO of the corporation?
Well, you know, again, I like your analysis to look at the practical and not legal fiction. The practical is that most of us know who our employer is. We sign paper. We sign up with an employer. We get the paycheck from the employer. And so it's not some other party. It's not. So if you're working in GM, as you proposed, Representative Gatto, your employer is GM. It's not the federal government. It's not the state of Michigan. It's no one else. You know who your employer is. In that system, by the way, fortunately, you cannot sue your employer, and that system has been respected. Many an employee has to live with that system that they cannot sue their employer. I've met with, I can think of a parent of a 19-year-old kid who was killed on the job in Anchorage, and the family got $20,000 for that debt. because that's all the worker compensation system provides. And they lived with that. But believe me, if he had got killed by a project owner or some third party, all of us would say the third party should be responsible. And I think that's where safety emanates from. When we have to be responsible, we typically take it very serious.
Follow up?
Just a follow up. So let me see if we can go back to an analogy. My employer is probably the legislative affairs agency. They're the ones that cut the check. But the state of Alaska is really 670,000 people who this building and all the legislature is. There's no building involved. It's really the population. So under any scenario, if I were hurt here and the state owed me some work comp, would I be able to go one step further and sue the public?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, no. And I think that is fortunate because I don't think that would be fair. However, if there was a general contractor repairing the building and suddenly the wall fell in on the people in the room there and it was caused by negligence, I think we'd all say, well, the negligence of the party that did that ought to be responsible, and then there'd be an offset. So the work comp that would apply to you would be paid back to your insurance company, to the work comp insurance carrier.
Okay, one more.
Follow up.
When we were working on the building next door, the Stewart building, they were building a sky bridge, and a crane fell over. And let's assume there was an injury, because a couple people, I think, were injured, but not to the point where their injury was life-threatening or terminating a person's ability to work. But they must have had an employer who would have been the contractor who took on the job. How far up the line could the injured party go if the crane fell over, pretty negligent on someone's part? Could they go to the next level, which would have been the person who issued the contract, which would have been the state?
Representative Gatto, through the chair, there has to be negligence. So there's certainly nothing wrong with the state issuing a permit. Obviously, if a party is negligent, and we did hear of a couple fatalities in Low 48 with cranes in the year 2000, it was about 2008, two in a row made the national news where people were killed in San Francisco and I think in somewhere back east by cranes falling off skyscrapers and killing people below. And if they were negligent, I think we would all agree traditional value says you have to be responsible for your acts. And if you cause that accident, your insurance company should have to pay for that.
Thank you. Any more questions? We thank you very much for your testimony. Can we go next to Kip Knutson with Tesoro, please? Kip, are you with us?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your time. My name is Kip Knutson. I'm External Affairs Manager for Tesoro Alaska, and I'm based in Anchorage.
Welcome.
I think it's positive today that everybody that is testifying and in the room is interested in the concept that an employee should go home in the same condition that they arrived at work. So I think the public policy debate should really focus on how do we make sure that every employee avoids injury or, God forbid, death. So with that in mind, I would ask you to set aside SB 303. I think adoption of this language would undo a reform that has created a safety benefit for the Alaska workplace and specifically for Tesoro. I don't believe that tort liability motivates safety programs. Current law has allowed us to dismantle cumbersome and quite frankly bizarre legal barriers between our safety programs and those run by our contractors. The coordination of a project owner and a contractor safety program results in a better safety culture and ultimately a safer workplace, which is achieving what we all want, which is employees that remain safe. Now, I've heard supporters of this legislation say that the bill will restore the concept of you break it, you pay for it. And I will maintain this concept was really not in place prior to 2004, and SB 303 won't bring us any closer to it either. In fact, prior to 2004, the concept was more as, if, even if you don't break it, hire a very good lawyer. The no-fault standard of workers' comp has, was adopted to eliminate uncertainty for the employee and employer in cases of injury or death. Regardless of fault, the worker would be compensated. Prior to 2004, the law contained a loophole that allowed uncertainty to remain for employers, both the project owner and the contractor. This bill is going to reopen that loophole again. I have heard supporters of this bill use the word immunity. No employer, either contractor or project owner, is immune on a worksite currently. All are ultimately on the hook to provide workers' compensation coverage. In return, the no-fault standard is applied to remedy an injury or death. I've heard the supporters of this bill say that between an employee and an employer, workers' compensation as an exclusive remedy is okay, but that between a subcontract employee and the project owner, workers' compensation is not adequate. It cannot be okay in one case and not in the other. Ultimately, if someone thinks that workers' compensation is not an adequate remedy in the case of injury or death, regardless of the worker's employment relationship, then this debate should focus on that deficiency, not on expanding tort liability. I think there's a great deal of lack of clarity on the world before 2004, specifically regarding control of workplace and allocation of fault. And Representative Holmes has asked the question a few times, and I'd like to just try. I think the issue of fairness pre-2004 and current law has been set aside in the workers' comp deal. It's not fair for a project owner to be sued regardless of fault, as was the case prior to 2004, for example. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there questions for Kip? If I don't see any questions here at the table, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Can we go next to Maynard Tapp, please? Maynard, thank you for waiting. Are you with us?
Yes.
Welcome, Maynard. Would you introduce yourself and any affiliation for the record, please?
Yes, my name is Maynard Tapp. I'm an owner of Hawk Consultants, LLC. We're a small Alaskan company that has worked in, primarily in the oil and gas construction and maintenance projects in the industry here in Alaska. And I recommend that SB 303 be set aside. We have recently passed our million-hour mark for no lost-time injuries. It took us 25 years to get to this milestone, but we're very happy to get there. We believe existing workers' comp law is sufficient in its efforts to protect workers here in Alaska. All of our clients, like Alyeska, BP, ConocoPhillips, Denali, and ExxonMobil, hold us to the highest commitment for safety, which someone mentioned earlier. That is that everyone goes home in the safe and healthy condition that they arrived at work this day. We are we ask our employees to watch out for our fellow workers. With this in mind, there is no need to support Senate Bill 303. All this would do is increase cost for insurance to cover an indefinable risk. This insurance premium cost for risk causes us to pass these costs on to our clients. And the excess costs added to the projects, added to projects difficulty in qualifying for economic viability, the reduction in the project developments will result in reduction in project developments, along with excess taxes collected under ACES, and has and will continue to reduce the investment in building Alaska's resource funding base, and therefore reduces jobs for our citizen employees. I believe the workers' compensation insurance fees sufficiently protect our employees in Alaska. Therefore, I'm against SB 303. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Maynard. Questions? Representative Holmes has a question for you, please, Maynard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, Maynard, I want to congratulate you on that safety record. I think that's very admirable and exactly what I think everybody, regardless of the side of the issue they're on, is striving to attain. That said, I'm going to ask the same two questions that I've asked before. Do you think that in the event that somebody is injured or killed due to the negligence or criminal negligence of the general contractor or project owner, that they should be immune from any liability?
Well, as others have said before, if you're saying criminal negligence, I don't know that workers' comp covers that, and so therefore it wouldn't come under this bill, I suppose. Again, I'm not a lawyer. I'm just a small business owner. So I don't know that I can specifically answer the tone of the question. I don't see how it's covered by workers' comp and insurance and so forth. Therefore, it wouldn't fall under this bill.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I think we'll clear that up later. Mr. Chairman, the second question is, do you think it's fair that subcontractors' workers' comp rates go up when it was the negligence or criminal negligence of the general contractor or project owner?
Well, we're all of those, as far as I understand, all of the rates for all of the jobs that are covered under workers' comp are a shared liability by all workers and all companies in the system. So that's how those rates are set. So therefore, I guess it's fair that that everybody's rates go up when things aren't dealt with. But that's it's to me, it's almost impossible to quantify the risk set forth in your scenario, because it doesn't sound like those people that are injured outside of the work environment. I don't know how they would fall under this law.
Maynard, I see no other questions, and thank you to you for the many years that I've been able to enjoy your testimony. Thank you very much for your testimony today.
Okay, thanks a lot.
And we go next to Mike Combs with Combs Insurance Agency. Mike, would you introduce yourself and your affiliation for the record, please?
Hello, this is Mike Combs with Combs Insurance Agency. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I've been in the business for 37 years. I run a small office up here in Palmer, and I've been involved in legislative affairs for with the independent insurance agents for several years. And when this bill came up, it was kind of a rehashing of a Senate bill that was proposed a couple years ago. And this one has some language issues that need to be pointed out. Under Section 1, it states that AS 2330045A is amended by Senate Bill 303 to state, if the employer is a subcontractor, the contractor, and that in this context means the general contractor, is liable for and shall secure the payment of compensation to employees of the subcontractor unless the subcontractor secures the payment. Previously, the contractor became liable for the uninsured subcontractor's employee. Becoming liable for the uninsured subcontractor's employee was only triggered by the subcontractor's failure to secure workers' compensation insurance. Now, with Senate Bill 303 changes, the contractor, in this case the general contractor, is the first one liable for and shall secure the payment of compensation to employees of the subcontractor. In order for the contractor, the general contractor, to be first one liable, the contractor must maintain employer status with the subcontractor's employees. Section 3, AS 2330055, states the liability of an employer prescribed in AS 2330045 is exclusive. Even though an attempt is made to delete the employer definition under this provision, the term employer is still used throughout AS 2330055, and as a new definition of employer was not added to 055, then the definition listed in 395 is still valid. Under number 22, employer means the state or its political subdivision or a person employing one or more persons in connection with the business or industry coming within the scope of this chapter and carried on in this state. Since this legislation puts the contractor, the general contractor in this case, in the scope of coverage for this chapter, even though they may be able to transfer that obligation to the subcontractor by written contract, unless the subcontractor secures payment, the contractor should still be eligible for the exclusive remedy protection afforded under 055. We took and moved the general contractor into the first position as an employer in this case. I'm not sure why that was done. but it looks to me like in the language itself that's what's been done. There's been a lot of testimony about how workers' comp is not fair. There's nothing fair about workers' compensation. Workers' compensation pays for both the employee's negligence and the employer's negligence, whether it's criminal negligence or just straight negligence. The employee is protected at all times. I would encourage that this bill be set aside. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mike. Are there questions for Mike Holmes, Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to be a broken record. I was wondering, Mr. Combs, if you would address the two questions I've been asking. The first one, to reiterate, is whether or not a general contractor or project owner should be immune from liability if the person's injured or killed due to the general contractor or project owner's negligence or criminal negligence.
Do I believe that anyone should be immune? I'm not sure that anybody should be immune from anything. I'm just saying that the current laws that we put in place many, many years ago took away that immunity. We said we do not want to hold employers responsible for a negligence issue for employees. We want to then instead provide them with workers' comp, regardless of whether it's criminal negligence or just standard working negligence. We took that on ourselves years and years ago. What we have done before is we said all of these enterprises are interconnected during the construction project and should get the same immunity. Whether it's fair or not, I couldn't tell you. I don't believe anything's fair for someone else to be criminally negligent. And trust me, the OSHA folks and also the Attorney General's office feel the same way. If you are criminally negligent, there are other issues to deal with other than just workers' comp and general liability coverage.
Mr. Chairman, my follow-up is whether or not it should be the subcontractors'
yes,
workers' comp rates that go up if it was the negligence or criminal negligence of the general contractor or project owner.
Well, again, when it comes to safety issues on a job site, everyone that sets foot on that, whether it's the general contractor or subcontractors, are all responsible for the safety conditions that their employees are under. Whether or not and who causes the injury to an employee, it doesn't matter under workers' comp law because the employee is covered. Will the subcontractors' rates go up if they have claims regardless of who caused them? Of course they will. Will the general contractor's rates go up if he ends up covering an uninsured subcontractor's employee for injury? Of course they will. Rates do go up when claims are happening. So as a side note, that the rates actually for workers' compensation coverage have dropped virtually every year since the year 2000. This is related to workplace safety.
Well, Mike, I thought the market just softened up over the last few years as my rates have gone down, and I've been grateful for a more competitive marketplace.
Well, actually, I don't know if anyone is there from the Division of Insurance, but they would be able to testify that the actual rate refilings have been going down steadily every year. It's kind of leveled off at this point, but they have been notoriously been going down every year over the last 4 or 5 years.
I'm seeing a
I'm not sure it's tied directly to the changes that took place in 2004, because that did not affect workers' comp. The thing that it did affect was the general liability exposures.
Interesting. I'm seeing heads nod in the audience here. Representative Gatto has a question for you.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Combs.
Yes.
Yes, let's say an employer hires a sub, and the sub, he says, are you bonded, insured, et cetera? He says, yes, I am, but he's not. So there is no employment compensation insurance in the mix anywhere. And, of course, an employee gets injured. Who is employee's compensation on the hook for not monitoring something? Is the employee covered, or is it his only recourse is to sue the world?
Well, in no other industry do we require someone that's not an employer to be an employer, and in this case we do. If the subcontractor does not have workers' compensation coverage for an injured employee, that employee has workers' compensation coverage under the general contractor's workers' comp policy.
Okay.
Beyond that, if the general contractor does not have workers' compensation coverage, then there is covered under the project owner's workers' compensation coverage. We have two tiers above a subcontractor for recourse of workers' compensation benefits to an injured employee.
Follow up
by Representative Gatto.
Thank you. There must be a case, though, where the contractor, and it really ends there. There is no one else around. No one has employee compensation. What happens, you know, I'm just wondering, do they step in and does anyone cover the medical bills and then hope to get reimbursed? But is there anyone that steps forward and says, listen, you're going to have surgery, you're going to be on crutches, you're going to have to go to rehab, et cetera, et cetera. Lots of money involved. Imagine if the employee, you know, he just doesn't have a dime beyond his paycheck. Is there anyone that steps forward and says, I'll cover this and I'll get reimbursed from gosh knows where? Is that possible?
Well, Representative Gatto, at this point, if the scenario you gave actually took place, the employer, who is a subcontractor, is still statutorily liable for those expenses. Workers' compensation is only simply a transfer of the legal obligation to provide that coverage. Now, granted, if they are bankrupt and have no money, then, of course, it becomes less and less likely to collect. You would have to be bankrupt right up the line, though, because that succession of responsibility goes uphill in this case. If the subcontractor doesn't have work comp and the general doesn't have work comp and the owner doesn't have work comp, they are then on the hook from a financial standpoint to still pay for that workers' compensation benefit.
Thank you. Mr. Combs, we appreciate it. I don't see any other questions. We're going to go to the last person who wishes to testify by telephone. We still have Gail Voiglander available with the Department of Labor. Department of Law, I'm sorry. We're going to go to Janine St. John and Everett Billingsley with Linden.
Undermines that we operate in with contracts, employees are denied protection because of this, because of this contractual indemnity clause. We would pay compensation, and still, because of this underlying issue, we can be sued. So it's a serious issue for us in the real practical world of doing business. I think there's a number of issues that have been brought up today, and we, Lyndon, would certainly urge the committee to read and consider the court's opinion before taking any action. Just reversing the 2004 changes will increase the cost of doing business for us, and that's, you know, business unfriendly, and things would just be moving too fast. So we strongly urge that SB 303 is not the right answer. If time needs to be taken to continue to review this, that's fine. But we don't believe SB 303 is the right answer. Thank you.
Thank you, Janine. Are there questions? Representative Holmes?
Mr. Chairman, reprising my role as the broken record.
I'm really going to ask the question, Janine. It's okay. It's good to hear your voice, Janine. I'm going to ask the same two questions. I'm being predictable today. Do you think it's fair that general contractors or project managers be immune from liability when somebody is injured or killed due to their negligence or criminal negligence?
You know, I'm not a lawyer. I don't have a legal background whatsoever. And I know there are various remedies in various areas, so I'm actually going to let Everett answer this one.
Everett. Hi, this is Everett Billingsley. I'm the general counsel for the Lyndon Companies, and I've been practicing law for about 20 years in Alaska. And my response to that is, in the real world, the issue is the benefit of the bargain for the liability to pay the workers' comp coverage. So if a company is absolved from negligence, it's consistent with the idea of underlying the workers' comp system, that company, the upstream contractors and owners, should have the benefit of the bargain, the benefit of the exclusive remedy, if they're potentially liable for the workers' comp insurance coverage.
So, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to go ahead and ask the follow-up, which is, should the subcontractors' workers' comp rates, given that it's a bargain that structured, the subcontractors' workers' comp rates be the ones that go up when it's really not their negligence that caused the injury or death?
Well, first, I don't believe that I agree with the premise or the statement that the comp rates will go up with the 2004 reforms. I'm not sure they have gone up. I'd like to see some real statistics on that. But secondly, assuming they do go up, the increase would be more than offset by the litigation cost savings and any savings in the increases in general liability insurance premiums. Just a simple lawsuit for a relatively minor injury can cost easily $30,000 or $40,000 in legal fees to settle or to deal with prior to trial. And if the case goes to trial, these are far higher, which make slight increases in insurance premiums pale in comparison.
Good. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Billingsley or Ms. St. John, I would like the name of the November case and the citation, please.
Joseph Scheel versus Union Oil.
Would you give that again, please?
Oh, it's on this letter right here.
It's the court's opinion number 6436, dated November 20th of 2009, and it's Scheel versus Union Oil Company of California.
Do you happen to have a Pacific site on that?
No, I don't. I just have the advance sheets.
I see, and it's number 6436. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Everett. Thank you, Janine. I don't see any more questions. We thank you. We have now concluded taking testimony over the phone, unless anybody else has signed up. We still have Gail with the Department of Law available over the phone. We had a wish from John Grummet to go last here in the room, and apparently we wore his patience out. Is John still here? Oh, excellent. John, you're back. Okay, wonderful. John, will you come up, please? John, if you'll introduce yourself and any affiliation you have for the record, we're happy to have you here.
I'm John Grummet with Shattuck & Grummet Insurance. I also serve as the state director for the Alaska Independent Agents and Brokers. And I'll be brief because I know there's been a lot of consistent testimony. And I'll just state that the Alaska Independent Agents and Brokers are opposed to this bill. Like many people have said, we don't think it's the best system, but it's the system that we've got right now with workers' comp, and we don't feel that this particular bill is going to enhance the system at all. If there's going to be a revamping of it, then it probably deserves a little more consideration and a lot better look than just this bill. You know, I think the state, I would like to pose a question, and that is that I think the state needs to decide how they want to handle workers in terms of making sure people are covered and getting treatment, or if they just want to create another level of litigation. And, you know, there's talk about negligence here, but there's also the issue of partners and sole proprietors and LLCs, where people are allowed to be excluded from coverage when they buy a work comp policy. And you need to, whereas on the corporation side, they're automatically included unless they're excluded. So there's a lot of different things that are wrong with the work comp system, but we don't believe this bill solves them. And I would conclude my comments with that. I think that Mike Combs represented our association pretty well.
Thank you. Are there any questions for John? We appreciate your concise testimony. Representative Holmes.
Sure. Chairman, I'll keep forging ahead on this one. I was wondering if you would address the two questions, the first being whether or not general contractors or project owners should be immune from liability if the person is injured or killed due to their negligence or criminal negligence.
I don't think that general contractors and owners should be the only ones. I mean, this bill tends, I think, is just concentrating on the construction industry, and I would say, well, why just the construction industry? Why not everybody?
That's true. Hmm. How about whether whether the subcontractors' workers' comp rates should be the ones affected if they're not the ones at fault?
I don't think it's fair, but I think that that's what we're left to deal with right now.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative?
Would you repeat your last statement? I don't think that's fair, but, and I didn't get the rest of it.
That's the way the system is right now. You know, there's many different costs that go into that. It's just not simply that it's the subcontract. Your question was the subcontractor increase for that?
Yes.
I'll just leave it at that. No, I don't think so. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you taking the time to testify, John.
Thanks.
Now we're going to ask up Michelle Kale, please. Michelle, the committee has great sensitivity for your testimony. I mean, we welcome you here. For your, introduce yourself and your affiliation for the record, please.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Michelle Carl. Thank you. I'm here to represent my deceased son, Tyler. Unlike all of the previous people that have testified today, I can answer most of the questions that your board has posed because I have been trained in fire. I know exactly what your statute covers and what it doesn't. Unfortunately, I had to learn it the hard way. Excuse me. Prior to the enactment of your 2004 amendment, one of the reasons that it was proposed was to ensure that people were insured under workman's compensation benefits. And even if the, excuse me, even prior to 2004, regardless if the subcontractor or the project owner had insurance, they were required to have it. The workers lost all of their rights when 2004 was enacted, most of them unknowingly, because unfortunately you don't realize you have no rights until you are severely injured or killed. What did the workers gain in return for giving up all their rights? In lawyer speak, quid quo pro. They got none. I heard people talk today about OSHA and MSHA protecting us. I had to control myself with that one. The people that killed my son due to gross negligence, and there are about five different entities involved, and legally they were required to pay us $5,000. Were we made whole? I would like to in the eye and tell me that we were. Yes, your work compensation system is broke. This statute, or this bill, certainly isn't going to fix it. But it's a good start to at least give it on the same basis that it was for 40 years, where the workers had some rights if someone was gross negligent. Right now, a worker in Alaska is actually better off if there's no insurance at all, because that's the only time that they can recover damages. My son Tyler was not the only fatality on this job. He was working up in Nome in a construction site when he and his coworker were dropped about 60 feet or more from a man lift. My son was innocently getting a ride to the ground after working on the roof all day. I'm here today, obviously, in support of SB 303. Unless you or your own family are placed in my shoes, you're just kidding yourself if you think that that your current statute encourages safety. Since when does a lack of accountability encourage compliance with anything? MSHA fined one of the people on the site, and they are still fighting that fine, even though two people were killed. They have all sorts of recourse, and we have none. There is no cost savings, excuse me, as it stands today. Employers, subcontractors, and project owners, they're not only getting cost savings, but they're actually profiting from people's deaths and injuries. Employees are unknowingly assuming all of the risk, and no one is held accountable for their safety. Tyler and Craig, who were killed in that job, are proof of that. If you disagree with me, I would gladly get into a discussion with you today and get into all the details. I'm sure you don't want to hear them right now, but I would like to say that going to work should never be a grave mistake for somebody in the United States, but it is today. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Are there any questions for Ms. Kaylee? We're all sorry for your loss. I will remind members here in the room, our Gray Mitchell, the Director of Labor Standards and Safety, Brad Thompson is here with Risk Management, Trina Heikes is here with as the Work Comp Director, and Gail Voigtlander is still online with us with the Department of Law. Finally today in the room, we're going to hear from Senator Seekins. Senator? Welcome, Senator Seekins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I begin by saying I don't think anybody who acts in criminal negligence should escape any just punishment. I hope I can answer that question right up front. In fact, I don't believe my workers' compensation policy that covers my employees would be in effect if I deliberately hurt one of my employees. In fact, that's an exclusion that's, I believe, in my policy. But I'm not sure, but I'd have to check to see if I acted in criminal negligence whether I would even be insured. But it isn't a matter of being insured. The law is really kind of a strange law. You may recall, Mr. Chairman, that during the time that we were looking at workers' comp, we convened a task force to take a look and see what parts of workers' comp were killed, whether compensation was just or not. And I do not believe, Mr. Chairman, as a father of four and a grandfather of 13, that anything could compensate me or my family for the loss of one of my children. I'll say that right out front. Or even for one of my employees. I think it's a very important thing that we look at the safety of that. And if someone is injured and someone is killed, I believe just compensation should be there. We didn't address that when we took a look at this bill, number 323, back in 2004. If you take a look, and I think you have in your packet the the CS for Senate Bill 323 Judicial, amended in the House, you may take a look at that in your packet. And it read originally that an employer is liable for and shall secure the payment to employees of the compensation payable under these statutes. If the employer is a subcontractor, the contractor is liable for and shall secure the payment of compensation to employees of the subcontractor. At that time, the law said if you're a subcontractor, you don't have to have workers' compensation on your employees. The contractor is going to have to provide it. We didn't think that was right. So we basically started out with the employer of the that was on the job. The subcontractor said, you got to require it. And if you don't, then the contractor is going to be required to have it. And if the contractor doesn't, then the general contractor project owner is required to cover that person under workers' comp. We tried to close a loophole where you didn't have to carry it necessarily if you were a subcontractor. And we tried to make that very sure that anyone who was on the job, no matter what the job was covered under workers' comp. Or was, I would say, not covered under a workers' comp policy, but was liable for and shall secure the payment to employees of the compensation payable. Now, the compensation schedule was not something we addressed. We did not want to at that point, and we talked about it in the task force, what was just compensation? As I said earlier, I'm not sure that anyone can be compensated in terms of dollars or anything else for the loss of a family member. Total sympathy there. Absolute. We did not touch that. The compensation schedule is set by law. Not touch it at all. But what we did say, as we looked into workers' comp, we found out that there was kind of a, what I would call a scam going on, Mr. Chairman. And that was, and this scam is one that's practiced every day by the state of Alaska, if you want to call it a scam. And that is, for the state of Alaska or for many project owners or general contractors, in order to get a contract to work for them, you have to sign an indemnification agreement. Every state project requires indemnification agreements, Mr. Chairman. Every one that says, if one of your employees sues us, you have to defend us in the lawsuit, and if there's a judgment, you have to pay it. So the employer has to pay for the insurance coverage or be liable for the coverage. But if someone sues the state, the employer has to hire his lawyers, defend himself in the state in court, and if there's any judgment, pay that as well. While it may not have been called double dipping, it was double jeopardy. Double jeopardy on the part of the employer, and we thought that was wrong. So what we looked at is to say, if the state has this indemnification, how about other companies? And you know what? We found, Mr. Chairman, major employers or major project owners on the slope, for an example, or around the state, building buildings, everything else, the municipality of Anchorage, the city of Fairbanks, they all have indemnification agreements in their contracts. They say exactly the same thing. That says, if in order to get this contract, you must indemnify us against any lawsuit brought by your employees and any judgment that's incurred. Very simple. Double jeopardy. Double jeopardy down the line. And it was being done. I would venture that there are trial attorneys either online or sitting here who practiced that double jeopardy on a regular basis. And what we found, we couldn't really prove it. What we found was very interesting, that there were even adjusters for insurance companies who would call their friend the lawyer who specialized in this kind of double jeopardy and say, oh, I've got an employee of so-and-so, and he's got a contract with BP or whomever, and he was injured on the job, and you know, you could probably go ahead and file that lawsuit for providing an unsafe workplace. And you know what? That would start the thing going, and the employer immediately was back in the role of double jeopardy. So we took a look at it and said, well, you know, double jeopardy isn't fair just for non-governmental agencies. The state doesn't want to give up their indemnification clauses. In contract law, they're allowed. And so we tried to take a look at how can we make sure that there's coverage for everyone in the process without coming up with the situation of double jeopardy for the employer, the contractor or subcontractor downstream. That's what this bill was intended to do. The other section, and I forget who asked the question, on the vendor whose primary business is sale or leasing of tools, equipment, other, we wanted to exempt anything having to do with products liability. If a crane company built a defective crane, there was still a lawsuit that could come out of that. It had nothing to do with workers' comp. If they had a front-end loader that blew up and hurt the person, we wanted to make sure that the manufacturer of that front-end loader still had that product's liability out there as a possible remedy for those people that were injured. But we found that we had to equalize this thing somehow or another, so that employers didn't do that. And literally, Mr. Chairman, there were millions and millions and millions of dollars that went through this process. Now, we found out, yes, that, you know, we knew that. We knew that, you know, if there is a judgment that comes in, the insurance company gets to recover what they've spent out. But in the meantime, the contractor who had the policy had an experience modification on his policy, and his rates went up. Like that. Then if the insurance company recovered the money, the rates didn't go down. In one case we were aware of, it took 3 years in a lawsuit against the insurance company to remove the experience modification that they no longer had paid out. So the whole thing was meant to try to find a way to make sure that there isn't that double jeopardy in there, but there's still protection for the employee at all levels. Now, I'm not going to argue about the rates. I got into that discussion. You can go back and look at the record. We think that in some cases we're paying too much. In some cases, in the area of palliative care, so we're being very generous. That's a whole different discussion. And that's one of the discussions that you guys here now, not me anymore, but you guys here need to take a look at. If that system is broken, fix that side of it. But don't allow double jeopardy now to come back into the system. There were attorney's offices that specialized in these kinds of cases. And when that Supreme Court case finally came down and the Supreme Court upheld the law and said it was all right, man, didn't take long for this new law to come out here. And it, you know, I've known the senator from Fairbanks for a long time. We used to play basketball together back when neither one of us had gray hair. You know, I see him at the hockey games. He's a hockey supporter. Two of my son-in-laws played for the hockey. We know each other. And I know that his firms also handle these kinds of cases. I know that. I know other attorneys who handle them as a major part, if not exclusively. And it did concern me a little bit as I started to take a look at this, and that if I, as an automobile dealer, when I was here, I would have had to absolutely declare a conflict of interest on something like this. And it was alluded to from your question, Mr. Chairman, but I know that attorneys, and I know Representative Grunberg inquired about the restaurant side of it, but I have a son who's an attorney as well, and I know that defending him or prosecuting him, there can be a lot that goes on in this, and then there was. It was a huge litigation side. The trial attorneys, what do they call themselves now? I forgot. They fought this bill pretty hard. But all we were after, and all we tried to do, and I think we did it well, and the Supreme Court agreed with us, was to say, no double jeopardy here. And that's exactly what was happening and would continue to happen today if we reverse this bill. If we pass 303, Mr. Chairman, it will happen again, guaranteed. And downstream, no matter who it is, and the state of Alaska will benefit from it, continue to benefit from it. Every contract they sign has an indemnification agreement. If that's not true, I'd like the state to tell me that, but I've seen those contracts.
Senator, Representative Herron has a question for you.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, it's obvious you have a lot of knowledge in this issue, plus I'm sure many others. But what was the, related to Senate Bill 323, what was the genesis or what was the spark that said, I got to do something about this?
I had never had it happen in my company. I hire a few contractors occasionally to fix electrical problems or plumbing problems in my building. It was brought to me by the State Chamber of Commerce. Sometime prior to my being in the Senate, I was on the Executive Committee of the Chamber of Commerce. I left there in order to take on I became chairman of the Dealer Council for Ford Motor Company. Couldn't do both, so I left the chamber on their executive committee and moved on. And when I was in the Senate, when I came into the Senate, the state chamber at that time came and said, Ralph, you know this problem exists. Can you address it? And that's how it started. And I think there were quite a few members of the chamber at the time that brought me in examples of what had happened to them and how, as contractors or subcontractors, they had faced and had to pay that double jeopardy. So I know it was millions of dollars.
And I will say, for the benefit of those in the room and members, just so far as experience modifications go, you have a rash of work comp claims in a calendar year. The claims are not closed. They leave intact a contingent liability that far exceeds the damages that have presently been paid to the person who suffered a work comp injury. You close out the calendar year. You go up for your renewal. And oftentimes, although that year is not counted, oftentimes it takes a remarkably long time to wipe off these contingent claims. And so when your experience modification is factored in, it's often factored in on an inflated dollar loss that never materializes, but your ability to recapture it is similar to the complaints around this table that when the price of a barrel goes up, gasoline at the pump goes up 10 cents, and when the price goes back down, it takes forever for it to go back down 10, and it usually only goes down 6. And that the work comp system, broken as it is, and many, many various spokes of this broken wheel. That is certainly one of them, and one that chaps me. I don't know if it's related to 303, but it certainly is. It's just work comp. Is it the failure of work comp to be sufficient for all is part of why we seem to be, in the chairman's opinion, trying to import an artificial remedy? Is because work comp itself failed in the same way that we heard from Michelle, who testified before us. There are embedded failures in workers' comp, and for the chair, and herein lies the hurdle rate for Senate Bill 303. Senate Bill 303 is for me an inadequate solution for the embedded problems that persist within the work comp structure.
And
Senator,
Mr. Chairman, if I can supplement my answer to Representative Herron. I think what was happening, if I recall how it was presented to me, and I think what employers are after, is the benefit of the deal. We're required to pay for workers' comp, and it ensures that those claims will be paid. And at that particular time, by the way, you may remember, Representative Gerberg and Representative Ramos, that, and Representative Gatto, and Lynn, that there was a workers' comp insurance company that failed.
I do remember that. Whoa. Yeah.
And we all ended up paying for that, for those claims that were out there, through the rest of our policies in the rest of the state. So when there was no one left to pay, we all ended up being the payer in the state of Alaska.
Before they failed, they sure had great rates, because they offered my coverage, and I was delighted with the rates that we enjoyed.
But I think the members were saying, we want the benefit of the deal. They were saying, if we pay, we want the coverage, and we don't want the double jeopardy that comes with it. And that was what we were trying to fix. That is what we fixed, and that's what the Supreme Court said that we fixed in a constitutional manner. It wasn't to affect anything having to do with the compensation paid, what was right, what was just, or anything else. We tried to talk about that in a task force, but that task force really drug out and was still dragging out by the time I left the Senate. And I'd be glad to answer any other questions.
Thank you, Senator. And for the benefit of members, it's 5 p.m. We began at 2:45. We've been at this for 2 hours and 15 minutes. The Finance Committee is out. For those that are interested, the decoupling bill passed out of House Finance, Senator Pascoban, to the pleasure of some of us around this table. And thank you for your work on that. We have requested the Speaker's office that we have another half an hour to try and hear our way through this piece of legislation. It's not the desire of the chair to recess and take this up, since we may be on the floor for many hours. I don't desire to come back here at 10 o'clock, and I don't think the Senator wants to lose a day. So what we need to do is to truncate our questions.
Let me ask.
You're going to want to confer with Senator Pascoban, because today's Friday.
Let me ask.
Representative Gruber.
Is it your hope to take a vote on this now? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, sir.
Oh, okay.
Yes, sir. So, Representative Gruber, questions for Senator Seekins?
I'd love to, but I don't want to delay a vote.
Right, yeah. Okay. I'll be brief.
How about one, Representative Gruber, for old time's sake?
We're glad to see you. And I still remember the gerbil in the back of the vehicle.
Yes. But
the horse bill.
Yeah, I remember that. And we did a number of tort reform bills, Mr. Chairman, Representative Gruenberg. And in all cases, what we tried to do was to get down to being fair and just, and every tort reform bill I put in, Representative Holmes, exempted gross negligence. And I believe, you know, in that regard, criminal intent like that, there should be a blanket prohibition. But that project owner is only asking for exactly the same coverage that the contractor and the subcontractor have. Exactly the same. So if you want to get rid of that for the project owner, get rid of it for the other employer down the line.
Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Seekins, is there a difference, in, at least in your experience, between gross negligence and criminal negligence?
I'm not a lawyer either. I played one on TV, I think. As,
I enjoyed that.
But I did have, I would tell you that gross negligence is clearly defined in statute, and I would bet criminal negligence is as well. But we, in everything we try to do, as Representative Gatto, through the chair, we said in the horse bill that Representative Gruenberg mentioned, which was a livestock bill, from gerbils to yaks.
My wife still won't let me get a gerbil.
We exempted gross negligence because we didn't think that was right. When someone acts in a grossly negligent manner or in a criminal manner, I don't think they should be exempted from other penalties. I don't believe so. I would say that if you're going to do that, it should apply across the board in all cases. But what we tried to do was say we got exactly the same coverage for the person who is also likewise liable for the compensation, provided that the downstream employers do not. And I guarantee you, if we go back to the way it was, we will see immediately litigation that'll be crowding the calendars, and we'll see immediately the guy who bought the insurance policy be back into a situation of double jeopardy, because you have not eliminated, and I think the state would go bananas if you tried to eliminate the contractual ability to say we that you can indemnify, or that the indemnification clauses, is that the right word?
Well, Mr. Chair, we did that. Actually, for your information, we just passed such a bill, and it's now on its way to the governor. It's House Bill 366. It prohibits indemnification agreements relating to motor vehicle transport. And maybe this is something we should look at, too.
But that's one of the things. If you don't delineate that, you've got your guy that's the small guy right downstream that had to sign the indemnification agreement in a position of double jeopardy. That's what we tried to eliminate. At the same time, we tried to make sure that there was coverage for every employee on the job.
Well, I've got, six questions for
the Supreme Court said we could talk. Thank you.
Thank you,
Chair.
Thank you, Senator.
Questions?
Representative Gatto?
Yeah, could we get a question to the Department of Law?
Absolutely. I have half a dozen questions that Jane's prepared for me for the Department of Law. Any other questions for Senator Seekins? Senator, what a privilege to have you here. And how unique to have two such fine men, such opposite points of view, and two men that I respect so very much.
Well, as I said, we've played on the same team, and we've played on opposite teams at the same time. And I have great respect for the senator as well, and I have a great respect for all of you who I know sacrificed from your lives, from your families, from your incomes to be members of the legislature. Thank you very much.
Mr. Senator Seekins, Representative Gruenberg.
Same for you. Regardless of what side of the aisle we sit on, we all appreciate your service, and Connie, and the fact that you guys were down here, and we enjoyed having you as part of our family.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator. All right. We're going to go to Gail Voiglander with the Department of Law. Gail, I have half a dozen questions for you that I'd prefer to get concise answers to, that Jane has helped me with, and then Representative Gatto has a question for you also. Gail, are you with us?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman. Gail Voigtlander, Department of the Law, and I'm the supervisor for the Torts and Workers' Compensation section in the office. I was told that the request was for a tort lawyer, and that's my background. I don't have a background in the workers' comp, but I'm here.
Thank you. Well, then, if these questions don't apply, just say pass. And here are my questions for you. One, are all subcontracting relationships covered by SB 303, or is this simply in the construction trade?
Mr. Chairman, my brief familiarity with this bill is that there's no language in this bill or in these provisions that restrict it to the construction context.
So any subcontractor relationship, you'd be able to pierce that veil with whoever the project owner was all the way up, whatever chain existed, paralegal that went to work for an attorney, any subcontractor, is that my understanding correct?
Mr. Chairman, that is my limited understanding, that there is nothing in the provisions in the root statutes that we're talking about or in this bill that confine it or limit it to a construction context. So it would apply to all the contexts where you've got subcontractors, contractors, and owners.
Thank you. And before we wind up, Senator, I'll pose that same question to you as per Representative Gruenberg's request. Second question, please, Gail. How would Senate Bill 303 change the exclusive remedy provision of workers' comp?
Mr. Chairman, again, this is more a workers' comp question than the tort, but my understanding is that what it changes is that the project owner no longer is required to pick up coverage of comp. So that being the case, the project owner is no longer under the provisions of AS 2330055, because that part is struck by this bill as being employer for purposes of the exclusiveness of liability.
Thank you, Gail. And if it's not your bailiwick, just say pass, and you won't lose points. Number three, please. On page one, lines 9 through 12. On page one, you have the bill in front of you. On page one, lines 9 through 12, would the contractor now be liable and have to secure payment for the sub's employee and also be liable for a tort action? Doesn't this fly in the face of work comp's sole remedy provision?
I am sorry, and I know at this late date this is not any help to you, but I'm going to have to take a bye on that because that is putting me too deeply in the workers' comp area.
No problem. We have Trina here with us, so we can pose the question to her if it's in her venue. Number four, do indemnification provisions in contracts with subcontractors protect project owners and contractors? Do indemnification provisions in contracts with subcontractors protect project owners and contractors?
Mr. Chairman, I would have to say that it's going to depend on the contract itself. I have to say that I have seen contracts that required the subcontractor to cover both the contractor and the owner, but I have also seen where the contractor's subcontractor contract is limited to their relationship with one another, and that more generally I think the case is that the contractor is who the owner is looking to in that relationship. Okay. For indemnity.
All right. And then let me ask you, why does the state believe that their contracts should contain indemnity provisions? This goes back to some of what Senator Seekins offered in his testimony. Why does the state believe that their contracts should contain indemnity provisions? And for that matter, the producers that I talked to, they say, you know, they have provisions in their contracts. They call them knock for knock.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know what the knock for knock. I haven't heard that term applied before, so I'm not sure what that is. I think on the general question of what state contracts require, some of that is set forth in statute, and some is just good practice. Here's the problem and the reason, and I'm trying to be succinct. Given Alaska law in terms of retained control, there are scenarios where the state would simply be a deep pocket to go to in a tort lawsuit, and so they would a plaintiff would simply come up with a theory by which they think they can reach far enough to go to the state for a tort remedy. And given Alaska law and retain control by a project owner, it can be fairly broad. And so the better practice, the more prudent practice, is to have indemnification, which the state pays for. You know, in a situation, you know, if you put out an RFP and you're requiring the contractor to provide certain levels of insurance and certain protections, both contractually and through insurance, It is reflected in the bottom line of the bid that is prepared and presented to the state. And the state's experience is that that is the better way to manage the risk to the state.
And Gail, finally, my last question then is if Senate Bill 303 was really to work as desired, wouldn't indemnity provisions have to be prohibited from contracts so that nobody could enjoy indemnity?
I'm unable to
yes.
come up with a succinct answer on that on this short notice of whether that would be required. Now, there are some types of contracts that are governed by statutes where you cannot totally shift the indemnity to another entity. And that is true in some contracts with the state, and so that the indemnity that's required by the state excludes acts where the sole negligent act is that of the state, that they're as opposed to scenarios where there are a number of potentially negligent acts, all of which come together, and that is true in the construction contracts and the DOT standard contracts. There is although they require indemnity, statutorily there is a limit as to the indemnity that can be required, and so our state contracts have that exception within them in order to comply with state statutes.
Thank you. Representative Gatto, you had a question for Gail.
Thank you. Just a second. Yeah. Gail, the question was on the difference between negligence, gross negligence, and criminal negligence. And I think we can all get to negligence. I think we can all get to gross negligence. The word criminal negligence, the word says criminal. Is it a crime that you are going to, have you committed a crime now with the word criminal negligence?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, I have been listening throughout this hearing, and I know, or I'm guessing that the reason for the questions about criminal negligence is the opinion from legislative counsel, which was unable to find cases that would directly address the criminal negligence context. In terms of a definition for criminal negligence, my only suggestion is that one can certainly turn to our state criminal code and the definitions in there, and I'm about to pull it up.
Representative Gruenberg has beat you to it, and while we're taking your taking that from Representative Gruenberg, could I ask Gray and Brad and Trina to come up to the table, and we'll just do a very go ahead, Representative Gruenberg.
Okay. It's in AS 11.81.900, subsection A4. And it says, for the purposes of this title, that's the criminal code, unless the context requires otherwise, a person acts with criminal negligence with respect to a result or a circumstance described by a provision of law defining an offense when the person fails to perceive a substantial and unjustifiable risk that the risk will occur or that the circumstance exists, semicolon. The risk must be such of a, must be of such a nature and degree that the failure to perceive it constitutes a gross deviation from the standard of care that a reasonable person would observe in the situation. And the, and that's the end of the quote. And I would say that the level of negligence must be, in answer to Representative Gatto's question, a, in the words of the statute, gross deviation. And I'm happy to pass this over. Do you want me to pass it over to you?
Well, Mr. Chair, yeah, in Senator Pascan's second paragraph in the sponsor statement, he gave a very abbreviated form of what you just said. But I was really looking, I think we're defining gross negligence. I just don't know what you have to do. You have to commit a crime to be criminally negligent, in which case the cops come and put handcuffs on you. Or is the word criminal simply... Does the word criminal have a different meaning when we say criminal negligence?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, you and I are tracking on this. When I heard that discussion by the discussing criminal negligence, the only context that I know that that's used in is in criminal law as a mental state that's required as a necessary element for a type of crime. For example, a type of vehicular manslaughter, a lower form of that is a crime based upon the mental state of criminal negligence. So I think that the criminal negligence is in the is a term of art for application for criminal laws, and I haven't seen it used in for application in civil in a civil context.
Mr. Chair.
And in criminal cases, of course, if someone's prosecuted for a crime and convicted, part of the sentencing can be restitution in terms of any injured victims.
Representative Grunberg.
Oh. Two places where it really is used, Representative, is in criminally negligent homicide, and that's 1141.130. A person commits the crime of criminally negligent homicide if with criminal negligence the person causes the death of another person. The other place where I know it's used is in the what's called the Dram Shop Act, which is serving somebody illegal. It's not just a standard of negligence, it's got to be criminally negligent, and I could find out that's in Title IV.
So, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative
Gatto. I'm not finding the distinction. You run them over with your car, criminally negligent homicide, or you set them up here on the job, criminally negligent. Do we not use the word homicide here when you had the same result?
Well, I think you could, because if a death results, you know, criminally negligent homicide may be with a vehicle, or it could be like in a mine disaster, you know, in West Virginia.
Gentlemen, any questions for Gail? Gail, seeing none, we thank you very much for your testimony. We'd like to go to our modest roundtable. If I could have the three of you introduce yourselves for the record, and then before you answer a question, if you would indicate who you are so we don't drive Susan crazy on our last day together.
Yes, I'm Gray Mitchell. I'm the director of the Labor Standards and Safety Division at Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
Welcome, Gray.
Thank you.
Trina Heikes, director of the Division of Workers' Compensation.
Brad Thompson, director, Division of Risk Management, Department of Administration.
Members, questions for our panel? I know you had a question, Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, I have a question for Trina. We heard discussion back and forth about workers' compensation rates before and after 2004. Can you tell us, we heard that the bill that passed in 2004 reduced workers' compensation rates. Did workers' compensation rates go down after 2004?
They have been declining because of safety. Reduced number of injuries for the past decade.
Reduced number of injuries. Okay.
Oh. And that is the force that, of course, your rates are set on based on two elements. Number one is your payroll times your risk, and your risk or your experience modification has to do with the number of injuries you have had.
And And, Mr. Chairman, a follow-up to Trina. Would you expect that rates would go up if this bill passed, or would you expect there to be any effect on rates?
That's probably a better question for the director of the Division of Insurance, Linda Hall.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I have a couple of questions for Gray Mitchell while we're here. One is, we heard discussions about safety programs in relation to the bill, and that I think a more or less direct quote we heard was that prior to 2004, the law actually discouraged safety programs. Would that be an accurate statement?
Representative Holmes, through the chair. In occupational safety and health standards, there's provisions that hold a controlling employer liable for safety violations at a site. That would transfer to a general contractor. Nothing about the change to workers' comp changed the liability for occupational safety and health standard compliance liability. So does that answer your question?
I believe so. Follow up on that, Mr.
Please.
Chairman. So you wouldn't expect that if this bill passed that there would be anything to discourage safety? You don't think that, that the safety is really affected one way or the other? Is that my...
Through the chair, I just don't see it being a different standard. You know, as far as the occupational safety and health standards that the state of Alaska enforces, there would be no change.
And, Mr. Chairman, a follow-up, sort of a new question. We heard Representative Gatto was asking some questions about a recent unfortunate incident across the street on the Sky Bridge. I was wondering if you could shed any light on any of the questions that Representative Gatto was asking earlier about what happened on the Stewart Building Sky Bridge incident.
Through the chair, my recollection of the accident was that two workers fell. They were glaziers working on the glass on the overpass. The piece of equipment that they were operating after we did our investigation was determined to be not engineered for that particular use. It wasn't designed to lift personnel. And so in that case, the piece of equipment was actually owned by the prime contractor on the project. And in that example, both companies were held liable for that accident.
That's Liz, right. Representative Holmes, Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is that criminal negligence then?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, no.
Well, Mr. Chair, they employed a piece of equipment, in your words, not designed for the task. Put people on it, it tipped over, to my knowledge. That may have been not designed for the task, meant that it didn't have outriggers or something, didn't have safety devices. It tipped over, and they fell. If that's not criminal negligence, then I really am lost as to what constitutes criminal negligence.
I'd like to follow up.
Please go ahead, Representative.
Yeah, I'm not so interested in the equipment there because, you know, it's equipment's designed for something, it comes with instructions. But here, the contractor allegedly let some people use that and either didn't train them properly or I don't know what happened. That's pretty serious. Any comment?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I was basically operating off the top of my head, and so there were other elements to that case, and you've raised one that I didn't speak to, but yes, the training issue was part of that particular incident, and the individual who was operating the equipment wasn't properly trained, nor were the individuals who were working for the subcontractor up on the platform properly trained in fall protection procedures. So, you know, there's...
Oh, Mr. Chair, yeah, I didn't mean to go there because people aren't very often prosecuted for criminally negligent, whatever it is. And it doesn't sound like it was we shouldn't go there. No death resulted or anything, right?
Are there
Chair, that's correct.
Yeah. Are there other questions for our panel?
Look.
I feel that we've vetted this issue quite thoroughly. Is there anybody else in the room or online who wishes to testify on this issue?
I wonder if the sponsor wants to.
We certainly are going to invite the sponsor back up. I'm just checking on everyone else. Is there anybody else in the room or online? All right. Seeing none, I'm going to close public testimony on Senate Bill 303. We're delighted to have the sponsor back before us. Senator Pascavan, I would welcome any remarks from you and then any questions from members for the senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in the interest of time, I will not meet every issue that's been raised. I hope that I will get to the points that are most relevant.
Senator, if I may, I got a note that says finance is back on. It's back in. So carry on. So
all right.
So you're welcome to.
I shall, given the hour, in any event, be succinct.
Yes, and I'd like not to be taken advantage of, Representative Grover.
I'd never take advantage of you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, as the starting point for this conclusion, I will start where I also started at the opening, which is the intent of Senate Bill 303 is to return Alaska to the good public policy, which was adopted even before stated, but certainly has been with us from statehood and existed and worked well in this community for over 40 years. There is, it appears, uniformity in the sense that workers' comp is not fair. We have heard from the sponsor of Senate Bill 323 that in 2004 they did not look at just compensation as a guiding point in enacting Senate Bill 323. But what they did is they eliminated just compensation for at-fault conduct. In 2004, they injected the concept of fault immunity into the workers' compensation issue. All the more reason for me to be brief. So again, I start with the premise that in 2004, the workers' comp change eliminated just compensation for at-fault conduct. And yes, at that, before 2004, the tort system, the liability system, did provide a remedy, and it was a delayed remedy. Why is that? Because it was a process that said you are only held accountable, you are only held responsible if you are at fault. And again, in our system of apportionment, if you're 25% at fault, you pay 25% at fault. If you are 100% at fault, you pay 100% at fault. The Chamber of Commerce has agreed that the workers' compensation system is broken. We agree. And I also submit to you that it's broken when a contractor or project owner who is at fault can kill or injure a sub's employee and is not held accountable. That is, by definition, broken, and Senate Bill 303 fixes that. We do not in any way question the commitment to safety. No one should misunderstand that. The commitment to safety is acknowledged and it is encouraged. But one has to understand that there are incidents. We all know that there are incidents. And the issue here is when there is fault is whether responsibility and accountability should attach to the wrongdoer. I mean, that is a very basic component of, I believe, a fair society, that if fault attaches, the wrongdoer is the one that should be responsible. Now, the word was used that there was a scam going on, and the scam was with respect to indemnification. And I would submit to you, I don't know that I would use the word scam, but that wasn't the workers that were involved in that process. These are the business owners that are deciding at this high level of capitalism, whether they shall assume risk or not assume risk. It is not the workers, however, who are involved in that process. And the public policy, again, as Representative Grunberg pointed out, that those issues as to whether those indemnification agreements are good public policy or bad public policy has certainly been before this this legislature, and I also agree that I believe that they are bad public policy. But I repeat, as I've said throughout my presentation, do not allow the immunization of at-fault conduct to continue. You do have a system that immunizes those that are at fault that should not be immunized for their at fault. Now, the term when it comes to the indemnification issue that was raised by Senator Seekins, he uses the term double jeopardy. And I think that that's a false concept, because double jeopardy is something that's imposed upon you. Senator Seekins, though, however, is talking about a system of indemnification that is self-imposed. They impose that as a business owner on themselves. Double jeopardy is a wrong term to be using when one addresses the concept of indemnification clauses within any contract. We know that there is no open floodgates. There was not open floodgates for 45 years. If, in fact, Senator Seekins is true to his word and wants to address what he calls as the scam of indemnification, he should return the system to the system that it was before and which worked well in Alaska for over 40 years, and call upon this body to address the knock-for-knock system. Call upon this body to confront this indemnification process, but don't put it on the backs of the workers who are now unable to impose accountability and responsibility for the fault that killed or injured them. I would just conclude, we hear the bells ringing, and we know that every day we start our sessions, and we start it with a Pledge of Allegiance, and that Pledge of Allegiance ends with the phrase, and justice for all. And the question in part before this committee is whether those are hollow words for workers that are injured because of the fault of someone other than their employer and themselves. And I submit to you that good public policy does not make hollow the words that we end our Pledge of Allegiance to, which provides and justice for all should include all Alaskans. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would conclude, and if there are any questions, I welcome them.
Excuse me for one moment, please. Thank you. Thank you very much. Are there questions for Senator Pascoe? Thank you, Senator. I appreciate it a great deal. It is 5:30. We all heard the bells ringing. Before we make a motion for this bill, I just want to thank Representative Gatto, Representative Holmes, Representative Heron, Representative Grunberg, Representative Lynn. It has been a privilege to serve with you, for most of you, for 4 years, my missing vice chair as well, and our aides, and Jane Pearson. I just man, for a layperson, you sure made me look bright for 4 years in a row, and not any sick days, because I would look foolish if that would have happened. I'm very grateful to you for your help, Senator Pascoe. I have served with you for 2 years, and you are such an ardent advocate for your community, and I thank you tremendously for your work on Senate Bill 305 on decoupling. Insofar as overcoming the hurdle on Senate Bill 303, it did not happen for me, and we will find ourselves at odds on my support for Senate Bill 303. I appreciate it, but I prefer the version of, that was offered before I arrived here, and that irony is not lost on me. You know, this Fairbanks triangle that exists here, it's a very unique irony here, given this is the last hearing that I'll chair in the Alaska State Legislature. So I have no more questions for the Senator Pascan. Is there anybody in the room?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
Without getting any, if we don't have any other chance to say this, I've enjoyed having you as the chair. Sometimes, occasionally, we haven't agreed. But then, you know, the only person I say I agree with was my dog, and he would disagree with that. So I mean, it's, you know, you have a good sense of humor. You have a very warm personality, and I think that we've all appreciated that. And your courtesy putting up with endless questions and legal trivia, you know, appreciate it a lot.
As you pointed out, you are the ranking member of the Judiciary Committee, which is a round that we went around with some time ago.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Herring.
While we're waxing at the expense of the senator and his legislation, I have to say my service on this committee this year has been quite entertaining, sitting between the chairman and the
ranking member.
Thank you, yes. Sir. Thank you for your service.
And, Representative Herring took Senator Coghill's place at our judiciary table in January when he convened. So with that, the chair would entertain a motion to move the C version of Senate Bill 303.
Mr. Chairman, I move CS for Senate Bill 303, C version from committee with individual recommendations and any attached fiscal notes.
And I'll object. Susan, will you take the roll, please?
Representative Dahlstrom is not present. Representative Herring.
Yes.
Representative Gatto.
No.
Representative Lynn.
Yes.
Representative Gruenberg.
Yes.
Representative Holmes.
Yes.
Representative Rammers.
Sorry, would you scratch the roll? Would you take the roll again, please?
Yes, sir. Representative Herring.
No.
Representative Gatto.
No.
Representative Lynn.
Yes.
Representative Gruenberg.
Yes.
Representative Holmes.
Yes.
Representative Dahlstrom is not present. Representative Rammers.
No.
3-3.
So 3-3, Senate Bill 303. Fails to advance from House Judiciary, and we are adjourned.